I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. My pleasure to welcome to Conversing today, Laura Lee.
I wasn't recording.
Okay, sorry.
Unless you wanted me to record that story.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No.
Okay,
no.
Sorry. I was just rolling.
I'm rolling. No problem. Now. Sorry.
Not that I'm going to direct you, but could you say something besides it's my very great pleasure to welcome Laura Lee?
You mean bow.
Instead of just pleasure.
Bow more fully.
Well, it's radio,
I
Mark,
see.
So nobody can see you bow.
It's my bowing pleasure to welcome Laura Lee Ferrer today to Conversing. Laura Lee is the chief storyteller at Fuller Theological Seminary and the vice president of communications. That's a tag that some of you who are listening to this will have seen or heard perhaps before, but it seemed right that we should turn our attention to a conversation with Laura Lee because she occupies such a singular role in Fuller's life and in many ways represents and instigates, I would say, some of the most important things that are happening in how Fuller seeks to both embody and tell its own story. And because that story in this season is a story of such dramatic change and inflection and creativity, sometimes desperation, uncertainty, opaqueness, it's all the more important that we have someone help us tell a really complicated, really important story at a very vulnerable and profound time in the institution's life. And I'm delighted, Laura Lee, and thrilled, actually, that you are occupying this role. Thank you for being part of this conversation today.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's go back and, first of all, just acknowledge that it's a very unusual thing for an institution, not least perhaps a seminary, to have something called a person who's a chief storyteller. Before we come to that role, I'm more interested in your formation as a storyteller. So when you look back, what's one of the earliest stories that you think you remember in your life, and who told you that story?
It's interesting that you would say that I think I remember, because I'm not certain whether I remember this or whether it was just something that became part of the, you know, the history of our family, the self-made history. My mother tells the story that when I was very, very small, I used to tell very long stories, all one sentence, grab someone's attention. And there was one friend of theirs who was, for whatever reason, specially captivated by the idea of this little blonde-headed child rattling on, something that was clearly a story to her, and it charmed him. But I remember the time when my mother pulled me aside and tried to explain to me that some stories could go on too long. And that she worked out a signal with me.
Kind of story arc.
Yeah, so to speak. That's when it's working. That she would hold one finger up. And that was to signal to me that this story that I was telling was going on too long. Kind of like this one. And then sometime later, I was talking to this friend of theirs who was charmed no matter where the story was going. And suddenly I stopped in the middle of a word and walked out of the room, slammed the door. And he looked at my mom and said, what was
happened?
That? Yes, what was that about? And she explained to him about, you know, holding the single finger up, like, time to wrap this up. So naturally, it's funny enough to me that I tell everybody that. And so, of course, my friends or family members take every occasion, and as you will now,
to raise a finger
and say, this is about enough of that.
So it's an index finger, mm-hmm. worth noting.
There it is. Yes, worth noting. Though, whatever serves.
So when I have heard you describe your family, one of the things that I think I have gotten the impression of is that your family was a family of storytellers and that there were people who cared a lot about story in your family, regardless of family stories, but then also people who told family stories. So just tell us about your parents as storytellers.
My father worked in the music business and later taught English, which was the great joy of his life. But story was something that he admired. He wouldn't consider himself a storyteller, but he considered himself a producer of people who told stories. So he worked for a music publishing company, one of the first Christian music publishing companies called Manna Music, way back in the day. And so we grew up around the music that came out of that publishing company. Andre Crouch, for example, I grew up with him and all of his music and probably many other names that nobody's around to remember anymore, Audrey Meyer and others. And so they were always in our orbit. They were always telling stories. My mother was a singer, and she was full of stories because they were immigrants from the great state of Texas to California, where this music business was. And they were regularly telling stories about their families so that their children would know where they came from mm-hmm. and their family members. Because mm-hmm. for them, my mother was the only daughter and there were six brothers. So she had stories galore, you can imagine.
You know, it was a couple of years ago, I think, I told you about meeting somebody who had known your dad as a teacher. And this person, when he came to know that I knew you and that you were the daughter of this teacher that had so influenced him, to say he became electrified doesn't even begin to capture it. It's like he became speechless. He couldn't figure out what he could possibly say to me to convey to me what your father had meant to him, but then also to convey to you why he was so thrilled that he was meeting somebody who knew this teacher's daughter. That was like such an amazing thing. And my impression of that, looking back on the way he was describing it, was really related to storytelling. It had to do with somehow your father inviting him into a space that was rapturous and deep and profound and stimulating and perhaps one of the most important influences in his whole life.
Without question.
Can you expand on that?
I'm not at all surprised. I wasn't at all surprised when you came back and gave me his card and I saw his name and I thought, oh, yes, I know exactly what his face looked like when you mentioned my dad's name. I remember when Dead Poets Society, the film, first came out and I went to see it. And as I was walking out toward the parking lot, there was a group of people, a little clutch of people. It was a huge theater in Los Angeles, you know. A little clutch of people talking, and suddenly I heard a young man yell, "That's the daughter of the guy I'm talking about." And I walked over, I recognized him. He was one of my father's students. And what he was telling people was, that man from Dead Poets Society, that teacher, I had a teacher like that. I have pictures of my dad standing on his desk and teaching from there. I mean, he literally was just like that character. So much so that a sort of coda to that story, when my father was ill and just weeks away from passing away, he and my mother were living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and students came from all over the country like a pilgrimage. They just would fly there. They would come upstairs to see him, to say goodbye and leave. And I probably will never make it through this, but one of his students, come to think of it, maybe the very young man that you met. I remember when he was getting ready to say goodbye to my dad, and he put his arms around him and hugged him, and I heard him whisper, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." Mm-hmm. Sorry. "Oh, Captain, my Captain," he said. And that was the relationship that my dad had with his students mm-hmm. and that I had with him. So, yes, it's not surprising to me that you would come across somebody who would hear the name and have all of that just stir up inside of them.
So in your own formation, there must have been some way that he was particularly electrifying to you. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a person in a classroom is the same at home, and I realize that. But from the way you've described him, it does seem as though some of that did transfer, and it was the same in the classroom and at home.
He was the same person everywhere. The man you knew as a teacher was the same man at home, the same man who was a choir director at our church. And it's funny for me to hear you refer to him as being electrifying, because he really was not that. He definitely put the plug into the wall for many young people who did not know that they were capable of coming alive. But he was like many professors I know. It's why I have a really soft space in my heart for faculty. He was in his books. I knew him as a quiet person who studied rigorously, who worked, who read, who had a voracious appetite. He grew up, they were very poor. He taught himself to love opera. And he did that because he was in the service and he had a friend there who was a more sophisticated young man. And my dad, who, as I say, came from poor roots, made fun of something, some opera. And this friend of his name was Wit. Why do I even remember that? It was such a part of our storytelling lives, though. Wit said to him, "Don, it's not a good thing to make fun of something that you don't know anything about." And that chafed my dad. And he realized that there was something he didn't know, and it made him feel small. And he determined that he wasn't going to be small about that. He was going to make Wit proud of him for knowing. So he taught himself opera. And I can remember riding to school back and forth with him. And he would turn on, let's see, what station was it? I can't remember the call sign, but he'd turn on the radio and the first note of an opera, he could say what opera it was, who wrote it, and who was singing at that time. He would recognize it within the first few notes.
Because he became truly an aficionado.
He did.
He had
indeed
a vast opera collection, right?
Maybe you remember, do you remember how the Met used to run these, well, they used to have broadcasts right at lunchtime, and then they would have these contests where people could test their opera knowledge.
Yes.
My dad won that like 3 times.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, he was quiet. He was a studier. And as I told you before we started recording this, he thought I was outrageous because of things I would say or my sense of humor. Outrageous in a, it charmed him kind of way, but because it was so different than what he was like.
So what's interesting to me about that is that he's a channel of story more than the story himself. It was not a story about him.
Yes, exactly.
And he was electrifying, not in the sense that he personally was electrifying, but threw him past the electricity
yes
of story, which is partly what captured
beautifully
him.
Beautifully put, yes.
Right?
And he loved poetry and he loved story and he imparted that.
Right.
Like I said, similar to plugging into the wall and then giving something that brought his students alive.
Right.
And they adored him for it.
And was all of that in either conscious or unconscious ways part of what has shaped you most influentially as a storyteller from within your own years growing up?
I think so. Here's a little secret. Whenever people talk about what kind of storyteller I am, I'm really not clear what they mean. Because for me, this is the language that I grew up in. So all I'm doing is like having an accent or something. All I'm doing is talking the same way that I have always talked. This is the way we grew up. We always talked about the stories of our family. So I still have to sort of put it together whenever people make comment or ask me to talk about storytelling. I have to interpret into what I know they mean because
right
for me, it's my, like my native language.
Mm-hmm. And it really was your mom and your dad that mm-hmm were like this, right?
Yeah.
So then to sort of expand the circle a little bit, you obviously, like everyone, you end up going to school, you end up having a new cast of characters that start enriching stories. Tell us about some of the people along the way that became influences.
Hmm. I remember growing up in association, as I say, with these people in the music industry that my dad had relationships with. And Andre Crouch was a big influence on me because I resonated with him and his authenticity. Something about him that he was a complicated person. I mean that in the best way. That's kind of code sometimes now for somebody who's troubled. I didn't perceive him at all as troubled. He was rich, fully orbed, and I was attracted to him. I was tiny. I was 11 or something like that whenever he first started recording with Man of Music. And I learned from him what it meant to have a story that had its ups and downs, that wasn't all just polished and clean and good news, but how important it was for story to have one foot in suffering and another foot in hope. And for the story to straddle, as mm-hmm I've said several times before, there's a scripture that talks about how we start in suffering and we go from suffering to perseverance and that creates character and that creates hope. And to my mind, that's the arc of story. And that those of us who are storytellers or those of us who are artists, it's our job to have one foot in suffering and one foot in hope and to be the bridge that people cross over.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our job to cross, but to allow others to cross over through us or with us. So back to Andre, I learned that through him and through his music. That was probably the earliest memory I have of somebody who was a storyteller. And then, this is a little bit sad, but it's the truth. My storytelling influences were all dead white men. They were the people I read, the people I admired, the people who wrote things that I resonated with. Mm-hmm. I can remember when I was young going through this aha era of realizing that people were capable of writing something that was a soul experience, that could be brought all the way up from the gut, so to speak, mm-hmm. and into the mouth, that it could be, or it could come all the way up and out your fingers into words. And it wasn't that I aspired to doing that. I recognized it. I thought, oh, that's that thing that I feel inclined toward. Mm-hmm. So finding my way as a woman writer, particularly in the conservative church in America, and then finding my way as a filmmaker, that was difficult territory mm-hmm. because there weren't women role models mm-hmm. for that. So all my role models, persons of substance, were male. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of interpreting going on.
Mm-hmm. I want to just encourage those who are listening to this to think about their own versions of this story. Who are the people that have shaped you as a storyteller in a good way, in a painful way, in a challenging way, in a limited way, in an expansive way? I just think it's a very human characteristic that we all have the capacity. Some exercise it, including even professionally. Others exercise it endlessly on a personal and interior way. Some are also then public storytellers, but we're all storytellers. And I just think what you're giving us are your own story versions of how those narratives and intertwined links of narrative influence have affected you. And in your case, naming, for example, the dead white male as a significant part of that. But that did break out. Not everyone who is listening knows that you eventually go on to become an award-winning filmmaker. And why film as a way of storytelling? Why not writing alone? Why not just prose? Why do it visually?
Let me just say that it would have been easier if I had not chosen to do this. It is complicated, and there are so many layers of people and creation that are involved around it. It is super expensive. It has to be the most expensive art form. And to do that as an independent, and to do it as an independent and a woman without the support of a studio behind me, I often have felt like, why would I have chosen something so difficult? And I have been entranced by filmmaking, visual. It just combined so much of what I felt was my way of articulating myself. Mm-hmm. I was a musician starting out. Then I started writing for a living. I knew I wanted to incorporate visual into that. Film was an obvious direction for me to go. But it was also true that I think this goes back to my dad again. My dad was entranced by film, and he grew up in a culture where film was not, you wouldn't go into a film theater and be a Christian. That was a place where, that was a dark space in my dad, the tradition that my dad came from. And he was the first person that I ever heard of who taught a class at our church, in the basement of our church, on faith in film. This is decades ago. So I think I got from him his love for film and his clarity about his faith. And the way they merged for him was as obvious as it could be. And for me, I wanted that. I wanted something that had that multi-layered combination. I can remember he would rent films for his classes at school. This was something that was scandalous for him to do, is to play movies at school. He would rent a 16-millimeter projector from the Glendale Public Library, and then he would write to a catalog and order films that he wanted to show. The most pronounced one for me would be A Man for All Seasons. That was one of his favorites. So he would send away from those. Those would arrive in the mail. And I could remember what it felt like to open those canisters and smell the celluloid. I can remember the sound of what it sounded like when he would thread the the film stock through the 16-millimeter film. And we lived in a small house. We had a little stand-up piano. that we would have to roll away from the wall, and then he would show the movie on the wall. And he would always watch it just to be sure that there was nothing wrong with the print, quote unquote. But I probably saw A Man for All Seasons 50 times during my youth. So to put a little coda on that story, I remember many, many years later, we were, one of my producing partners, Tamara Johnston McMahon, she and I had just finished a film, and we had just met with a distributor, and the hopes, it looked really good that they were going to distribute this film. And when we came to the end of our conversation and they asked how much were we going to talk about God in the film, we said, well, as much as it's pertinent to do so. And it just became really clear from that moment that they were not interested anymore. And I remember driving home from that, and I had been invited to go to the Directors Guild. There was a screening of Man for All Seasons. So I went to see Man for All Seasons. It was my father's birthday, which I shared with him. So we had the same birthday, so it was a very rich experience for me growing up. And it was the first time that I saw Man for All Seasons in a theater. And I didn't expect to know anybody that was there. This was an homage to my dad. So I went in, I sat in the back. This was the most bizarre coincidental experience. I watched the movie, and a couple of things happened. As I was watching, as an adult, I thought I could make that film. I knew it wasn't beyond me to make it. Now, I'm saying I could make one of the greatest films of all time, in my opinion. I don't mean that I thought I was capable of the content of it. I knew I was capable as a filmmaker of making that film, that even that was not beyond me. And while I was sitting and watching that and thinking, could it be true? I mean, I know exactly how to do that. A woman sitting in front of me turned around and looked at me, and she said, "That reminds me of you." And it was Kathy Barsotti. Kathy Barsotti and Rob Johnson were sitting in front of me in that theater. And I hadn't noticed them. I was so enraptured with what was going on. And something about the film made her turn around and say, "That reminds me of you." So for me, it was sort of like Kathy Barsotti pointing at me is always the finger of God pointing at me. But it felt to me like, yeah, exactly. That's not only can you do that, but yes.
So did you just get up and go buy a camera? What did you do? What happened?
It was one of the first times that I felt like I had permission to make films the way I make films. And sometime a few years later, there was this sort of strange convergence where I was asked to speak about the filmmaker Krzysztof Kieslowski at a conference. And it was the same weekend that Terrence Malick's film Tree of Life was opening. And a friend of mine, Kiri Zuper, asked me if I wanted to go with her to see this because Terrence Malick, I didn't know him at the time. Malick was one of her favorite filmmakers. The combination of those two experiences on the same weekend, both of those filmmakers, if you were to think of a camp of filmmakers, they both belong in that camp. And again, here I am associating myself with, to my mind, some of the greatest filmmakers of all time. But in both cases, I recognized the way they made films, and I recognized that I spoke the same film language that they spoke, and it made it possible. It gave me permission. And this was just permission in the sense of encouragement along the way to continue to do what I was already doing.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. What's amazing is, if I have the story right, is that you pick up on these things, you cultivate this as a kind of avocational interest. It actually is your main vocation,
right,
in actual fact,
right.
But you had to support yourself. And
right.
One of the ways you supported yourself in recent years has been to work at Fuller Theological Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you were primarily, in my view, somewhat buried in an editorial job around Fuller's regular publications to its alumni and supporters in various ways.
Can I tell you a dream I had?
Please.
So just in case you're wondering whether the buried idea is actually true, I had a dream that I was sitting at my desk, hunched over my keyboard, and I was wearing a sod coat, and the sod was growing This is not funny, Mark. Stop laughing. The sod was growing so that it wrapped itself around the computer terminal and around the desk so that I couldn't lift up. I don't know. It's very hard to interpret what that dream means,
indeed,
don't you think?
Indeed. Something about buried, but don't need to press too far into
that.
Oh,
I don't think we should. No, not at all.
So while that's happening, you're filmmaking on the side, mm-hmm. really because it's your main passion and your vocation. But you're supporting yourself, like many filmmakers have to, by some other work. In this case, it was a work at Fuller Theological Seminary, a place which, unlike many seminaries, really gives, I would say, a significant pride of place, partly through Rob Johnston's influence and other people, to film and filmmaking as an art form, as an expression of humanity, faith, creativity, imagination, prophetic vision, right? All of that. So before we move to your current role, how did you hold those two things in tension? Because it feels to me like maybe they weren't in tension in your mind, but perhaps they were.
That's adorable. Gosh, two roads diverged in a yellow wood here. Which path am I going to take? Well, over the seasons, I've been at Fuller for a little over 15 years now. And for about 14 of those years, I really struggled with God. I knew that he called me to be a filmmaker, and I also knew that I was spending 8 to 10 hours a day at this institution where I was getting better at something that was not filmmaking, at least in the beginning of while I was here. But the thing that I really truly loved about being at Fuller, two things, or many things, but two of them were, one was that I was working for an organization whose mission I deeply believed in. I don't think I could have done otherwise. There was often a struggle of why me at a seminary, but it made so much more sense to me to be at a seminary where I believed in what was happening and applying my gifts, however much those gifts may or may not have fit perfectly. That would have made so much more sense to me and did make so much more sense than it would have made for me to be working for a studio, small or large, and be making films that I was ashamed of. Why? Or that just were superfluous to me. So it has made sense to me in that sense. But one of the second things that I have really appreciated about being at Fuller, because I'm clear that that's what you're asking me, is to tell you how happy I am to have this job.
No,
I am. I am super happy. No, I know. I'm joking. Was the opportunity to meet regularly with Bram Center students. Now, I'm looking out the window just over your shoulder, and three of them are in the garden right now. So I am watching walk by some of the gifts that I feel I've been able to harvest because I've been here at Fuller. Mm-hmm. And that is talking with young artists, particularly young female artists, mm-hmm. about their work and about their future and who they are. You know, often whenever students come to Fuller, it's a season in their lives where they're not sure what they believe. They're not sure what a calling is. If they kind of have an inclination what that calling might be, they don't know what to do with it. And here I am, a person who's clearly called to something else. And it was a long and very pointed journey for me to come to that clear realization. And yet I am not working in that space. I'm working at a job that God has clearly given me for provision and other things, because he is efficient and fecund and always makes much more out of everything that we offer him mm-hmm. than we imagine he will. But any student that may have sat across the table from me at any time in the last 15 years has heard me say that one of my favorite quotes is from Gustave Flaubert, French philosopher, who said, "Be calm and orderly in your life so that you may be violent and original in your work." It was important and has always been important to me to be calm and orderly in my life so that I can save that creative energy to put into the work that God has given to me. And it's not work that is likely to earn me any money or even backing necessarily, but it has its place in the world the way a poem has its place in the world, whether it earns any money for itself or not. And it's clear to me that both of those things are my responsibility. And you know, Mark, as well as anybody does, what happens for me when those things become so out of balance that I am unable to express the thing that I feel God's called me to, then that becomes an intolerable, like it's literally an intolerable circumstance for me. And in some ways, that's a mercy, because it always keeps me going back to that mm-hmm. in a way that mm-hmm. that is life-giving and mm-hmm. oxygen-giving for me.
I want to come on to this current season at Fuller and your role as storyteller. But before we do that, let the listeners in on some of your film projects. Maybe tell a bit about one or two of them.
Like a lot of young filmmakers do, a lot of independent filmmakers, I started in documentary. So the first one I made was about an opera singer friend of mine who just was built in such a way that she was made to sing opera. And this resonated with, I just lost my dad. It resonated with me. My dad's love coming from humble circumstances for opera. And then here's this woman that worked at a cubicle nearby at World Vision, I think it was, where we met each other. And then I heard her sing. And I realized that she had the chops. And she had been, somebody had told her when she was young that she had the voice of a spinto soprano, which is a rare voice, and that she really was made to sing. Now, here's a person who has a very similar struggle that I went through when I was at a certain season at Fuller. Right before I came to Fuller was when I finished that film and traveled with it to film festivals, that kind of thing. And the film is about the opportunity for her to be heard by a professional coach in New York. He happened to be Placido Domingo's vocal coach. And of course, I will never forget, we made the opportunity to get her in the room with this guy. And when she started to sing, or just before she started to sing, I saw him standing across from her in one of those little rehearsal rooms in New York, as everywhere. And he crossed his arms and he had a look on his face that was like, okay, how long do I have to do this in order to be kind so that I can get to dinner? And the moment she started to sing, his arms dropped to his side and he leaned forward and she sang about three notes and he charged her. Like he wasn't that far away from her, maybe 5 feet. He leapt across the room. Darling, darling, he said, what a voice, what a gift from God. And of course, we were just, my colleague and I that were ended up producing the film, just weeping in the corner because we knew it. She had God's voice in her, still does. Anyway, so we made this 30-minute documentary about her journey and what that journey looked
like.
What
is it called?
It's called Laundry and Tosca, in reference to the yin and the yang, or the suffering and the hope of being called to an art form that is not likely to ever come to an obvious fruition, but is something that you can't not do. So that was her story. And then the next story that I did, it was a movie called The Fair Trade about, again, my producing partner, Tamara Johnston McMahon, who is sitting in the room. So now I'm being very careful about giving her credit for everything she It was the story of the death of her fiancé, tragic death of her fiancé, who was also very close to me, like a son to me, and the process that she went through in that experience to find something more meaningful than the work she was doing. And she entered something that was, at that time, a brand new industry, which was the fair trade industry. So there's a long story to that, but write to me and I'll send you the DVD. No, I'm kidding. So that was my second film. And in each case, I learned more as I went along what it was like to go to film festivals. And so by this time, by the end of the fair trade, I'd been to probably 50 different festivals. And I saw how independent filmmaking worked. I had an opportunity after that to make another film with a friend of ours, Tony Hale, that was called Not That Funny. And I wrote this with a writing partner of mine. That was my first narrative feature. Very charming experience. We had a blast doing it. Then after that, I started on a project that is still, you're grinning and trying not to laugh, as probably everybody in the room is, right across from me as I'm not looking at Patrick O'Neill Duff, who's also the editor for this project. But it's probably, Tamara, I always underestimate, how long has it been?
That well depends if you count phase one or phase two.
But phase one and phase two, what does that tell you? 17 years, something like that? Oh, gosh. All I remember is that I used to take courage from, like, Richard Attenborough getting up after winning the award for Gandhi, saying he'd been working on for this for 14 years, and I thought, yes, I'm not the only one. It's a project called Praying the Hours. It was birthed during a season of time in my life that I was in deep suffering. I would say that the ground of my being fractured under me, and I fell through into a space that was unfamiliar to me. I never actually felt far from God. I know now that that's a gift because that's not the way everybody's journey goes. But time didn't make any sense to me anymore. I lost all sense of who I was in the world. It was a very, very difficult time. And I went on a pilgrimage. I wouldn't have known to call it that at the time, but 40, 50 days. I drove out into the desert with my old truck and I spent a lot of time outside. It's kind of a euphemism, but it was a raw period of time in my life, let me just say. And I discovered, I've compared it since then to what Alcoholics Anonymous say, that they do one day at a time, and that if they can't do one day at a time, they do 1 hour at a time. That was what that season was like for me. I couldn't live a whole day at a time by myself. I required prayer. And so I started praying at certain times a day, and I saw that after weeks went by that I was praying in this rhythmic manner. I would pray when the sun went up. I mean, it was kind of obvious in some ways. I would pray when the sun went up. I would pray in mid-morning. I'd pray at noon. I'd pray at mid-afternoon when the sun went down. I'd pray before I went to sleep. I would pray in the middle of the night when I would wake up agitated or concerned or sorrowful. And then during that season, I discovered that there was a monastery out in Abiquiu, New Mexico, which is where I was near. And so I drove to this monastery to see if they would let me, because I was staying either sleeping on top of my truck or inside my truck. I thought, I'll ask them if I can stay on their property, and then that way I'll feel safe. And when I go through this season of prayer, I won't be wondering, is it okay for me to be out here alone doing this? Well, little did I know, there are Benedictines, and one of their vows is a vow of hospitality. So if somebody comes to them requesting us, they have to say yes. So here I am, this woman, this outrageous woman, as my dad would have thought, asking if I could stay in my truck on their property. And I discovered they had a chapel, not a big surprise. The whole idea that the monastery just existed was a surprise to me. I mean, I came from a tradition that I'd never heard of liturgical year. I'd never heard of Advent. The only kind of traditions we had were potlucks and lime jello with banana slices floating in it, you know. So that was our version of a little high liturgical form, right? Well, you haven't had that jello then, clearly. But anyway, I would start to just go to the chapel to pray at these hours that had become rhythmic for me. And I discovered that they were always there. And of course, I made the assumption, being totally self-focused in the moment, that they just prayed 24/7. Well, not so. They prayed at exactly the same times that I did. And they were praying the same prayers that I was praying, using the same scriptures or similar scriptures, but the tone was always the same. It became clear to me that each one of these hours of the day, these hours of prayer, I had fallen into something that was as ancient as, or way beyond, before Benedict. But Benedict was the one who identified them as the office or the hours of prayer. I discovered that this was something really that I was tuned to recognize. Why would it be any different for me than it was for Benedict and for Francis, both of whom came out from the world into the desert and found this rhythm that they were made for? Please note, now here I am associating myself with two of the greats of religious history. Yeah,
high liturgical and theological points of view and filmmaking point of view as well. Yeah, it's good.
It's pretty great company. Mm-hmm. But that intrigued me to imagine, are we made in such a way that we are made to respond to this? And when I came out of this season of sorrow and I, you know, wasn't smelling like smoke anymore, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to imagine each one of the hours of prayer as a character and write through a 24-hour day with that ensemble of people? What would their lives be like together? And could I tell that story almost in an experimental way? Could I tell that story in such a way that people would resonate with it? They would say, oh, that's exactly what I am like. I feel exactly that way at 3 p.m. So here's an example. We are close to 3 p.m. right now. So this is the hour of known. The hour of known is when the shadows lengthen. And there's something about that time of day that breaks our hearts. We don't know why. Why does the way the light slants and create the shadows, why does it affect us the way it does? So it's based on this kind of idea and from them, as I say, characters, and those characters written into a story. So we will hopefully soon end up with a 6-hour feature.
So shorter than Shoah, but coming close.
We are. I would say we are. I'm looking over at Patrick. We are close, 4.5 hours into what would be nice. Much better than a rough cut. Mm-hmm. So now what we're going to do with it, no idea. But that doesn't matter. It's always taken its own shape. So that is the privilege side of being an independent and paying for your own work, certainly with the support of many others, friends and family. But paying for your own work, then you own it, and you can allow the work to go where it wants to go, whether it takes a shape that matches the market or something in the industry is irrelevant, really.
So when I come into the Fuller story, you're already deep into these projects, this water, this mm-hmm. rhythm of what you're doing internally for Fuller, largely editorial work, and then filmmaking work as your main vocation. And what I become aware of, not even yet knowing you or having even met you, but just trying to pay attention to what's happening on the campus, it becomes clear to me that you're a harbinger of stories and of people's lives. It's just evident that you're that kind of person and influence on the campus. And I remember walking up to you on the sidewalk randomly and saying, I have no idea who you are, but I think you might be one of the most important people at Fuller. And the reason I said that was that it was so clear to me that because of the way that you function relationally and interpersonally and I'll say soberly in relationship to that, not without joy and humor and all that, but I just mean with seriousness of purpose. It was clear to me that you might be the one that was as close to as anyone would be to having the pulse of what is Fuller, who is Fuller, really? Why is Fuller? And I didn't even know what your job was. Then I discover what your job is, and I think, well, that I guess makes sense, but it feels like a strange fit in a certain way because it feels like a straitjacket over somebody who's more outrageous than
or a sod coat.
A sod coat. I hadn't initially thought sod coat, but now that you bring that to mind again,
they grow.
It does seem to be fitting.
And may I just say, by the way, when you did that, I remember that, and I thought, well, wasn't that the nicest man? I wonder who he is. So I had no idea.
Yes. So then time goes forward. I end up in this unexpected role as president, and I'm aware that Fuller is not telling its story in a way that it needs to. And that's true in a thousand ways. It's true in print. So the first thing was retooling things so that you and a team of people that you assembled could recast something that has now become Fuller Magazine itself, an award-winning, remarkable, remarkable expression of creativity and storytelling at the core of all that we're doing. And then later came the development of Fuller Studio, which then became a video formatting of storytelling. Initially, it seemed as though it was the magazine that was primary and Fuller Studio that was secondary. Then it became clear that Fuller Studio was the larger keeper and Fuller Magazine was a case in point. And in any case, now they're two inseparable parts of how Fuller exists and expresses its story to itself, but also to its, I'll call it fan base of neighbors, friends, alums, et cetera, and then also to a much wider world that has no formal contact with Fuller.
Right.
And all of it has turned around storytelling. So I would say at this stage, your role as, quote, chief storyteller is that you're a sort of storytelling genius inside Fuller who has been able to bring around you other really great storytellers with all kinds of technical expertise that has helped to make and develop the things that have unfolded, each with their own individual contribution, but also with your capacity to build a functioning, highly productive team that I would say has completely recast how Fuller exists and embodies the story. Now, this is like all storytelling. It's not neutral, right? Because storytelling can only tell some parts of a story and never the whole story. And so you know as well as anyone that one of the juggling acts of a complicated place like Fuller is that there's always, you know, 4,000 stories to tell, not one story to tell.
Right.
And certainly not even one story to tell in only one way. It could be one story told in 4,000 ways, let alone 4,000 stories told in thousands of ways. And there's a juggling act in that, which is both the function of a narrator. It's the clarity around what it means to be chief storyteller, because then you become the person that enshrouds in a certain way a combination of stories. How do you hold all of those things in tension and still have a clarity of narrative line, which I think is one of the things that makes both Fuller Magazine and Fuller Studio so powerful? So it feels richly varied, and at the same time, it feels coherent. How can you do both of those two things?
Well, here's a dramatic answer, but it is what occurred to me. You follow the light. You look for the thing that is deepest inside of you, what our friend and storyteller Bobette Bester calls the gleaming detail. You look for that in the other, and then you follow that. You follow that light in the same way that I learned whenever I learned that I was praying the hours all those years back in the desert. I saw that the light showed me all day, every day, where to look to find God. It's one of the things that I love about film, because it really is about the light. Why does it stir us the way it does? The way the light is falling on you from the window behind you right now, it's a beauty. It is God resting on your shoulder. There's no way you can tell the 4,000 stories, 4,000 ways. It's too much. The way you tell that story is to find your own story and then see where it reverberates in the other. And if you can tell just a molecule of that, you have the DNA of that story. So, of course, you can't tell the whole thing, but if you can tell that, if you can get yourself out of the way, then find that gleaming detail. Tell the one example of that story that lets you know, quote unquote, who this person is. You can resonate with that. And an image can do that. A story can do that. A poem can do that. It's what we hope to do with the magazine, even though the magazine is 100 pages. It's never long enough to feel like we can tell. It only comes out 3 times a year. So to feel like we can tell all of the stories that are available and all of them in their great depth and breadth. And yet, if we're successful at telling just that part of it, that just one part of it, but to tell it truly. So not to tell all, but to tell one element of it and to tell it truly. Then you get both the clarity of vision of that person. You feel like you know something about them and your heart is moved toward them. It creates a relationship between you, and yet you still have the mystery of all of the rest of them to discover.
So that reminds me of Frederick Buechner's comment that when storytelling becomes the most particular, it becomes also the most universal. Hmm. It's a feeling that somehow if you try to make it midair in general, then it never feels right. Like it applies.
Because you have to disembody to do right. That, right?
But when you're actually very particular, then it actually allows more people to tag mm-hmm. into it than would be ever be right. Able to do so if it was more generic.
Because they will say in that rightly ordered way, not a self-serving way, but a rightly ordered way, I am just like that. Mm-hmm. And that's when the I becomes we. Mm-hmm. We are this way. Mm-hmm. My mother, who had the gift of intercessory prayer, and I mean intercessory prayer like she would spend 8 hours a day praying, and she prayed faithfully for Fuller. She would walk the property. She had a book that Fred Davison made for her that had all of the trustees in it and all of the senior leadership, and she would pray over each one of them every day. She used to talk about her intercessory prayer, and she would say that she was standing in the gap for somebody. And it was a certain season of time where I realized that that's what God called me as an artist to do. Again, back to this 1 foot in suffering and 1 foot in hope, that God called me as an artist to be an intercessor, like my mother was an intercessor. And she used to say that when you pray for somebody the way she prayed for people, you come to love them. When you tell a person's story and you see that gleaming detail of them and you're able, even just in one molecule, to tell them truly so that others connect to them, then you love them. And then there's no going back on that. You can't not love them after that. They belong to you.
I think one of the things that's been fascinating to me to watch you as a storyteller in this setting at Fuller is that on the one hand, you're always wanting to be extremely honoring of the particular detail of a person's story or a particular part of Fuller and the varied number of voices and perspectives and angles that people have. And at the same time, there's inevitably a role that you have perhaps in the other part of your job title called Vice President of Communications, mm-hmm. in which you have to also hold the big story that is the story of Fuller. Right. And I think at times Fuller and you and I get criticized for tilting either too much toward the singular story or too much toward the, as it were, the yes. corporate story.
Yes.
And the difficulty of how you manage those two things when, in fact, you're not just serving individual human interests. You are actually also serving an institutional interest or a movement interest or whatever it might be. How do you try to hold those two things together?
It makes me think of Max Dupree. You know what I'm going to quote in his book, Leadership is an Art. He said that every school, every corporation, every family should have a tribal storyteller, because without that tribal storyteller, you'll begin to forget who you are. That's why I have the title Chief Storyteller, even though that has made me open to a certain amount of, one hopes, friendly mocking on campus. One person who said, did they call you storyteller because the word dreamweaver was taken already? He doesn't work here anymore, but super coincidentally,
not related,
though. No, not related. What I do in my role is I stand in the gap. Like anybody who has a job that is way too big for them to take on their own, they become the person whose job it is to pay attention to that thing and to do their best to tell it. So my success, in my mind, is not judged by how well do I tell the entire story of Fuller, but how willing am I to be the person whose responsibility it is to do that. Does that make sense, mm-hmm. the difference between the two? Mm-hmm. And so consequently, every voice matters to me. And yes, if we skew in one direction or another, then we are honor-bound to course correct. It doesn't mean we won't skew in one direction or another. It means that we have available to us only the two eyes that we have and the stories that are in front of us and the amount of manpower, woman power, budgets that we have to capture them. And then we have to try to capture those stories as honestly and as fully orbed as we can. But I think that the story of an institution like Fuller, it has a narrative. It has a beginning and a middle, and someday it will have an end, even if that's when the great day comes. Telling the story of that is telling the story of a movement of a whole community of people. And a movement of a community of people is very much like telling the story of one and very much like telling the story of a moment, an hour, or as we were saying earlier, the gleaming detail. So the reason it's important for Fuller to know that is because we need to know where we came from in order to chart the course ahead of us in a way that is honest. We may say in the season to come, as many of us have, we need to course correct in many ways to be the new Fuller in Pomona. And that course correcting can happen. I mean, I truly believe this. So do all of my colleagues who work here in Fuller Studio and creative production with me. We believe that story can have an influence on that. Maybe the greatest influence on that. So this is a way I mentioned earlier that I had struggled for many years being at Fuller and asking God, why do you have me here when you've called me to something different? And there was something about this new season of knowing that we were going to move from Pasadena to Pomona. Something clicked for me. I don't feel that way anymore. I feel like, oh, I see why I'm here. I know how to do this. I know how to make this journey and I know how to tell about it. Does that mean that I'll do it perfectly? Does that mean that I feel like it's not a story that is too big for me to tell? Of course it doesn't mean that. It means that I am the one that God has given this particular job to. I understand it in the same way that I watched Man for All Seasons and thought I could make that. Is that something bigger or greater than I could ever do? Oh, very possibly, but I can make that film. I can make this journey with Fuller, for Fuller, on behalf of her. I can help her get there intact. I can help her become intact before she goes if she's not intact now. I can help. And that is clearer to me now than it has been at any other time in my time here at Fuller.
Well, I think we're in a period where the contributions of leaders around Fuller are needed at every level. They're needed financially. They're needed structurally, bureaucratically. They're needed academically. They're needed politically, ethnically, racially.
Yes.
But they are also needed in this fundamental context of story. And I can't express adequately how grateful I am that God's brought you to Fuller for this time. And it feels like a very different time than the first chapter of your season at Fuller.
It does. It is.
It feels like this is a release of your much greater giftedness and capacities than Fuller had yet had opportunity to fully give you vent for. And now it feels like it's as indispensable to our future as will we have the right financial plan? Will we have the right architecture? Will we have the right academic programs? Will we have the right story? And that is a very honored and important part of Fuller's life. And I thank you again for taking this responsibility and for the seriousness and joy and gift of it to Fuller. The challenge that it is, because it continuously brings us back to the central story of the gospel, but also to the implications of that story for all of our stories and Fuller's story as it goes out in all of the countries around the world where it gradually and eventually always seems to scatter. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being our chief storyteller. Keep doing this critical work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.